Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. And we're going to be talking about the tragic scenario that is unfolding today. And of course, Bob and I have been talking about it for a long time. The fact we were going to have terrible economic problems, and we're just on the beginning of this. Certainly, you can go over to Japan, they're having problems. One of their biggest banks over there is reporting significant losses. Over in Europe, why? Of course, they're having terrible problems of the economy, the housing industry, and in Spain is simply collapsing. Certainly, the purchasers are down in Great Britain. Germany's having trouble. Germany's the biggest exporter in Europe, one of the biggest exporters in the world, and yet their orders are down. Of course, they're having inflation over there, even though their interest rate is up around 4.5%. Of course, here in America, where our interest rate is about 2%, we're having skyrocketing inflation, but they're not telling the American people that. And the last count, what's inflation doing at the present time, Bob?
Well, the government says it's 5%.
What's it really? Of course, they're lying to us.
13.25%.
Well, that's really up from a week or two ago, isn't it?
Well, we moved it from 11.625% to 11.875% to 13.25%. And John Williams at Shadow Statistics, I think he's around 11.25% or 3/8 or 1/2, somewhere in there. And he's got his M3, which is the creation of money and credit by the Fed, at 15.9%. I've got mine at 17%. And Goldseek has theirs at 18%. So I don't know what I can't remember what Goldseek's inflation figure is. But I predicted earlier this year, maybe around April, that I thought that we'd have 15% inflation on the year. If they continued to increase the amounts of money and credit outstanding, which they have done. And I think that they're in a position where no matter what they do, they're stuck. I mean, they can't raise interest rates. The economy and the market will collapse. They can't lower rates because the bond market will collapse. And the dollar will collapse if they lower rates. And so we described the situation 4 years ago that they were going into, and it's unfortunately happened the way we called it. And we also said that approximately 3.5 to 4 years ago that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were both bankrupt, and they are. You've seen the actions by our government, the Treasury Department, as well as the Federal Reserve, in now guaranteeing the debt in behalf of the American people so they get to pay for it, to bail out the lenders, the banks, Wall Street, and most of the people who are going to be bailed out lied in their applications to borrow money to have mortgages.
But now aren't we
going to? It's really a criminal system.
Well, aren't we actually going to be bailing out the Chinese and the Saudis and the others who own the bonds there for Fannie Mae?
That's a good point, Stan. And you're absolutely that was a big factor as well, and I overlooked it.
And I think it's important.
And I'm getting old. What can I tell you?
Well, I don't think that at all. I think that people have to understand that we've given the Fed that's got us into this mess a blank check to simply bail out Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and it's going to cost trillions of dollars before we're over this, and the American people don't understand. This is going to destroy the value of our currency. Well, Bob, you picked the story up from there.
Well, you were mentioning problems in other countries. The average country is increasing money and credit at a rate of about 14% and have been for the last 3 to 3.5 years. And so this is not just a problem that exists with the privately owned monetary system called the Federal Reserve in the United States. It's just about everybody else. I mean, if you can believe this, you go to the Gulf states that are producing oil, and their inflation ranges from 10 to 20%. You know, I find it incredible. But it is that way. And, of course, they've had a lot of riots there because they import workers, and the workers get paid, and their salaries are worth 15% or something like that less than they were, say, 6 months to a year ago. So they want to get paid more money to offset that. And the money hasn't been forthcoming, which is rather short-sighted of the countries involved that hire them. And they're starting to go home, and I don't know who's going to do that hard labor that most people in the country don't want to do. And you mentioned Spain. Spain's going to be a disaster. Portugal will be a semi-disaster along with Italy. And I don't know how Ireland's going to come out on this, but it's not going to be good. Whether it'll be as bad as Spain, I don't know. It may fall in the category of Portugal and Italy. You know, from the very beginning, when they formed the Maastricht Treaty in 97, they said that one interest rate would fit all. And they also laid down the law of 3% for public debt as a maximum. And, of course, over time, the last 9 years, many of them have exceeded that, but they've then slipped back under the number 3%. The one interest rate fits all is stupid beyond words. I mean, how can you expect countries like the ones I've mentioned who...
Hold that thought. There was just a moment, Bob. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob's talking about what's going on over in Europe. And, of course, the thing is that you have a number of different countries with different economies. And yet, of course, they're saying, oh, well, we have to have a central bank, one interest rate for everybody. And, of course, you can't do that. Some countries are having inflation. They should be raising the interest rates. Other countries are stable. They should maintain their interest rates or even lower them. But there are real problems over in Europe. I just got a letter today from one of our supporters who just got back from Germany. He's German by extraction. He said that the prices have doubled over there since they went into Euro in Germany. He said gasoline is $9 a gallon in Germany. And, of course, the people over there are really hurting. How would you like to have the price of everything double here in the United States? Well, it's going to in very, very short time, but not just simply the gasoline prices, but food and everything else, and then it'll double again, double again, and double again, because when you do not have a stable currency, why, of course, the dollar money loses its value, and this is how you destroy nations. And this is exactly what the wicked people who control our Federal Reserve Board are doing. They've always known what was going to happen, and they're intentionally destroying our currency to impoverish our people. And then, of course, they'll come up with a new currency, probably gold-backed, privately issued by their people. Remember, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank created by the bankers, for the bankers, to enrich the bankers and to impoverish the American people. And boy, they're sure doing a good job, but now we're at the end of the line, and they know exactly what's happening. They just cannot tell the American people the truth, that the real rate of inflation, the real rate of unemployment, what is really going on, And if you depend upon television or the newspaper or magazines to get your news, you're going to end up simply in the poorhouse down the line. Go right ahead, Bob.
Well, getting back to the one interest rate serving all, you have Germany's real estate has not appreciated in value. And it's gone up 150% in the countries I just mentioned, except for Italy. And people don't realize it, but each country issues its own euros. And in so doing, they, you know, contribute to the total float of euros throughout the zone, which is now 15 countries out of 27 that are in the European Union. I think that figure is correct. If it's not, it's close. And so here you have this tremendous dichotomy of results and in the inflation of real estate between Germany and even France to some extent, with Ireland, Portugal, Italy, and Spain. And another thing is that the Germans are tired of carrying the account deficit, current account deficit, for the rest of the Eurozone. If they weren't exporting as much as they have been in the past, then there would be a tremendous balance of payments deficit caused by the others. In a poll about 4 or 5 months ago, Germans overall, 67% said they wanted the D-mark back. And 72% of the women said they wanted the Deutschmark back. So I guess you'd put it somewhere around 63% for men and 72% for women. And I lived in Germany in a long time, and the women are very smart there. So with that said, it's not very popular. And, of course, Italy has always blamed their problems in the last 9 years on the fact that they're in the Eurozone. And actually, they should have never been allowed in the first place, but they had to take them in. And they Mickey Mouse their book so they could get in. And it's a long story I won't go into. But it's the worst of all worlds. And I expect that once the deflation starts, that the euro will be abandoned. And that's why in Germany today, Germans are looking at the bills, the euro bills, to see where they were printed, and they will not accept euros that were printed outside of Germany. And so I think, you know, in 2 to 3 years when this whole thing crumbles, and maybe before, maybe a little bit after, but once it happens, I think that you're going to see the euro break up. So I'm not a big fan of the euro, and never have been. You and I both know, Stan, what its real reason is, to form a world financial dictatorship in a world government. And for that reason alone, we don't want to encourage things like the euro. It's the same thing in America. These people talking about the euro. I don't think it's ever going to happen. And if it does, I'll be very, very surprised. These people in the Illuminati, they've got so many problems. They're on the run. And, you know, these programs, Stan, we're getting to them. I mean, you know, I'm on 20 times a week, and with you and, you know, all the other programs that I'm on. And we're really, really having an effect. And they don't know what to do because they've cornered themselves. And there's no good way out. There's not going to be a recovery. There is going to be a depression, and the people are going to ask, well, how did this happen, and who did this to us? And I think that there's going to be criminal trials for a lot of people who are involved in the Fed and who have been in the Treasury Department, who are in investment banking and banking in the United States, and they know that, and they're terrified. And quite frankly, the only way to handle these people, upon finding them guilty, is to remove their wealth. You don't even have to put them in jail. Just take everything they've got away from them. and say, you're on your own. And, of course, put them on probation for 10 years so they don't go around doing any heinous things. And I think that's where we're headed. I think we're going to win. We're going to pay a terrible price. But that is the problem of the American public and the European public and the world public. They're all at fault. Nobody wants to know. Nobody wants to think about it. Nobody wants to learn about it. But they want solutions. Well, you can't get solutions unless everybody puts their shoulder into the problem and tries to solve it collectively as citizens of your own country. And, of course, we're concerned about the United States. And so these problems are not going to go away. And that's why I so strongly urge people to contact us with the group of banks that we have links to companies at great banks. And for those people who want gold and silver-related assets or Swiss franc government bonds, we can help them with that. We receive no compensation from anybody except the subscribers. I received an email perhaps 15 minutes before this program, and I was told by one of my people who's on the inside at Bank of America that they're on the hot list of 100 banks that have got problems and could very well fail. And so I thought it was very surprising that Mr. Bernanke, in a fit of honesty, at the, was it the House or the Senate hearings last week anyway, he said that IndyMac was not on their list. I mean, what can these people be thinking about? I mean, they're supposed to be experts. And here is a bank going bankrupt, and it'll happen on their list.
Oh, I think they probably, Bob, they're not
that stupid.
He's
lying, or they're incompetent.
No, I really believe that they know. They just lie to the American people. Everything's fine. Mr. Paulson said everything's fine. The president says everything's fine. You know, Bernanke said, well, we may have a little problem here for a while, but we're going to get through this. And of course, we're not going to raise the interest rates. We're not going to lower the interest rates. We're going to keep it right where it is. And you've got nothing to worry about because inflation, well, now they admit it's 5%. And they're simply lying. Anybody who goes to the food store knows that they're lying. Anybody who goes to the gas station knows that they're lying. The cost of literally everything is going up. Whether it's the cost of shipping, whether it's the cost of farm good, whether it's the cost of almost everything we buy today is going up, except for cars, and they're losing money on every car they produce. That's why General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are literally facing bankruptcy. We're going to lose our major automotive manufacturers, and that's one of the last major manufacturers we have in the United States outside of Boeing. And China now has all the plans, and they're going to start producing planes designed after our techniques, only with a lot of the stupid regulations, like, you know, you have to pump inert gases into the gas tanks, you know, to keep them from exploding. When, of course, the government knows that when TWA 800 went down, it went down because it was hit by missiles, but they can't admit that, and so they have to say, oh, was that central gas tank that exploded? That's what it was all about. Well, go right ahead, Bob.
Yeah, we've talked about these issues before. And it's tragic that there's so few of us speaking out. And I, you know, within the journalistic field, you do have publications that are not mainstream that occasionally speak out, but most of it's mainstream and controlled by Illuminati. And the same thing certainly is true of television. They won't even let me back on television, period. And with radio, we have to go to satellite and the internet and shortwave. And we have very few opportunities to get on mainline radio.
Well, I think, of course, the thing is that more and more people are giving up mainline radio, going to stations such as this one's that our listeners are listening on to shortwave, the internet. More and more people know something's wrong. And, of course, this is the important thing, is for our listeners to realize that very, very soon a lot of people are going to be destitute. They're going to say, how did it happen? and you have to understand, and you've got to be able to give them the answers. And of course, when enough Americans understand that we're controlled by a ruling elite that have created all of these problems, their goal, a new world order, a new world religion, a new world leader, at that point, they'll begin to recognize the spiritual aspect of what's going on, and hopefully we'll be able to take America back. Either that or we'll lose everything. Bob, go right ahead. Bob, go ahead.
Well, yes. I'm trying to pick up where we last left off. I was listening to you, and I lost track of what we were talking about.
You were basically talking about the fact that you were having difficulty getting onto major radio.
That's right. And so I just wished more people like us would come forward and join and get on the programs and advertise on the programs. So we can continue to have some help. You know, Stan, we're all men.
Well, I mean, speak for yourself, Bob.
How long do they think we can do this?
I know. Hopefully we'll be around for a little bit longer so we can. But the young people are coming along that I talk to, you know, that are listening to our program. They're listening tonight, and they've got their own radio programs, maybe back in Nashville or maybe back somewhere in a station in the South. But they're learning, and one of these days they're just going to pick up when you and I aren't here.
Well, I hope you're right, as we sure need help. But we're really making some terrific inroads. I'll tell you what tells me that. You know, normally we were getting about 100 emails a day. Now we're getting 300 or 400 that I have to answer. and you know, besides being on the radio, and then besides that, also, you know, spending a lot of time writing. You know, it's like up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and 10 o'clock to bed, and it's a tough schedule. It doesn't leave a lot of time for yourself either. But we've been able to do it, you and I. I don't think anybody in this is as old as we are there?
Well, no, I think that I'm probably one of the senior people on the circuit.
I think you are the senior person.
Well, that's all right. God's given me my mind, and certainly the body's wearing out a little bit, but my mind's still doing pretty well. So we'll just keep going as long as we can.
We get Ed Griffith, he's a little bit older than I am, and I think Alan Stang is my age.
Right.
And Tony Hilder, who was on today with Alex, he's a year younger than me, I think, maybe two. And we're getting long in the tooth. But anyway, back to the subjects. There's some good things happening. In order to keep the financial stocks from being plummeted by shorts, legal shorts, and illegal naked shorts, the government, SEC, steps in and designate 19 companies that you couldn't naked short. Now, mind you, naked short is illegal. So don't do any of those illegal acts on those 19 stocks. But, hey, you can do it on all the others. Well, they got taken apart on that one over the past week. And they've said that they are coming up with a proposal early next week for making all of the naked shorts cover.
Now, of course, will that affect then the gold and silver? Because, of course, this is where I think they're doing a lot of shorting and driving those prices down artificially.
You're absolutely right. And that could create a rally unto itself, which could help gold. But it pertains to an awful lot of other stocks, particularly stocks in the over-the-counter and on the bulletin board that have sold for $10 or $7 or $4 or $3. And they're sometimes even higher. They have destroyed more companies than you could ever believe.
Hold that thought, Bob. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Bob is simply mentioning the fact that they passed legislation that you cannot naked short. Now, naked shorting is a term used on the commodity market or on the regular stock market where you're selling a stock that doesn't exist, that you don't have, that has not been borrowed for you. Ordinarily, somebody has to borrow that stock if you're going to sell it short. And then, of course, the idea when the price falls, you buy it back and then you make the spread. You make a good profit shorting if you know when something's going to go down. But, of course, what they've been doing in the gold and silver markets, that they've been naked shorting. They've been selling gold and silver they don't have. There are far more contracts out there that where silver is sold than there is silver in any of the warehouses that is in existence today. And that's how they're keeping the price of gold and silver down. So, but anyway, how is this going to impact on it? Are they actually going to change the laws and basically demand that the speculators follow the laws that are in existence?
Well, I think they're going to give them a time frame. But I don't think it'll be a long one. Because they really want these shorts covered because it'll buoy stocks. And in that, it'll keep them, at least for some period, from going down more. They're probably very unhappy that it will help the gold and silver shares, particularly the producers and the middle-tier stocks. And I don't think it'll help too much, if at all, the exploration stocks. But that's a very strong factor. And if anybody looks at the chart on gold, long-term chart, they'll see that there is a very bullish formation, if they understand charting. And gold is just about ready to break out and roar. And I think between now and December, that we'll see $1,200 gold, and we may see it substantially higher than that, depending upon what happens. I mean, if we have, like, Bank of America ready to go under, and they merge it with, say, J.P. Morgan Chase or something like that, then gold and silver will go berserk. And that, of course, too, will put further pressure on the dollar and drive it further down. And it's just the worst of all worlds for those people. And because we understand it, we can take advantage of it. And again, it's too bad we don't reach more people so that they could participate in saving their assets. But there's only, you know, we only can do what we can do. And sooner or later, the public will come in. Unfortunately, they'll come in at substantially higher prices. And then it will be like it was back in the mid to late 90s when everybody says, well, you have a mutual fund. Well, what will be happening, and I've seen it happen before with gold and silver, is did you buy your gold and silver yet? And when I heard that, I knew it was time to get out. That was in June of 1980, and we bailed everybody out of the market, and we were quite fortunate. But that's the way markets are. That's the way people are. And this is nothing unusual, understanding people. I mean, there's been books written on the subject, The Madness of Crowds. That's not the whole title of the book. I can't remember it offhand. But there is madness in crowds, and people do strange things. And they may bid gold up to $8,000 or $9,000 an ounce. Who knows?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Apparently over in Vietnam, because the people over there in Vietnam have lived, you know, a terrible life, certainly with the Civil War there. And then when the Americans came in, because they were occupied by the Japanese, then they were occupied, you know, by the American forces, and then the communists took over. And it's been just a very terrible life for them. But now, of course, because of massive American investment over there, why the economy was coming along. So a lot of the Vietnamese were doing what you know they understood. They were buying gold. In fact, my understanding is that they were buying so much gold that the Vietnamese government has shut off all imports of gold in an effort to so they won't have a negative balance of payments or negative trade balance. And certainly, you know, this shows that people in other countries understand what happens when you destroy a currency. They understand in China that a lot of the Chinese are buying gold. They understand in India. It's just here in America where everybody thinks, well, money is simply, it's all green. And they don't understand. This is simply a promise to pay nothing because, of course, it's not redeemable in anything. At one time, our money was redeemable in lawful money. I still remember when the day that they changed the inscription on the Federal Reserve note, it used to say, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at any branch of the United States Treasury or Federal Reserve. And then one day we woke up and without any mention in the media just said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, period. And at that point, we were in a fiat money system, a system where money had no value at all. And, of course, it's going to continue decreasing in value. Well, you go right ahead there, Bob, but I thought it was just so interesting that the Vietnamese people, you know, the poor, tragic people over there, but they understand money far better than the average American does, and they're actually trying to get into gold, and that's why the government's cutting off of all imports, but it'll be smuggled in, the people will trade it one way or the other, as they always have, because gold has value, and paper money, well, is worth the paper it's print on, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Well, go right ahead. You know,
people have been clipping coins. It goes back further than Julius Caesar. I wrote an article one time, and somebody wrote in and told me when it started unofficially. I think it was about 3,000 years before the birth of Christ. And so it's nothing new. And clipping coins, which were made out of either copper or gold or silver, it was just like depreciating the value of the currency. So today we do it by printing fiat dollars, if you may. But yes, foreigners everywhere in the world understand the value of precious metals, particularly gold, as a monetary instrument. Americans certainly don't understand. Europeans have a little bit better understanding. And where you find people who really understand is in Asia, which you've just mentioned, and to an extent more than in the United States, in Europe, in Latin America, and of course in Africa too, but Africa is such a poor place that not much goes on. I got a letter today from a subscriber saying that a man who was born in Rhodesia 40 years ago, who's a professional hunter, is leaving the country. He's finally given up on what's going on there. And it's such a tragedy. It was it's such a beautiful country. And Mugabe has just absolutely ruined it. And unfortunately, I think the same thing's going to happen in South Africa. But I had to mention that. We lived over there in South Africa in Rhodesia 35 to 38 years ago. We spent 3 years there. And I know you lived in Africa as well, Stan.
Yeah, from 74 to 77, yes. It really was a wonderful place. Rhodesia was a beautiful country, so was South Africa, but that's no longer the case. And they were working out their problems as far as apartheid in South Africa. They didn't even have it in Rhodesia. That's why, of course, our State Department set out to put a communist in power there, and they succeeded. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapin from International Forecaster. And if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. But before we go on, Bob, why don't you get out your website? Why don't you get out your telephone number so people want to get in touch with you, they can.
Well, you can get a free introductory copy by going to our site. The forecast is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. We publish on email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, about 30 pages each time. And we also have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet that goes out twice a month. Our site address is theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternationalforecaster.com. If you want to email us with a question, want some info on the banks or in different kinds of investing, that address is international_forecaster@yahoo.com, international_forecaster@yahoo.com, And if you'd like, you can call toll-free to 800-375-4188, 800-375-4188.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's important that people understand that the whole world is going into economic chaos. Certainly, they're having problems in China. They have inflation there. Their economy is slowing down. There will, of course, be civil unrest to an extent. They'll have to get the military out and start killing people to put down the unrest. Certainly, there's inflation in India. There's inflation throughout Malaysia. There's inflation in Europe. And, of course, the whole economy of the world is beginning to simply contract. And this is, of course, what you'd anticipate. This is the end result of a world fiat money system. This is the first time we've ever had. This isn't a world fiat money system. It's usually been isolated in areas, but now it's the entire world. And, of course, America leads the way. And as America's certainly industry contracts, as our purchasing contracts, and more of our people just don't have the money to go out and buy everything they want to. And one of these days, people are going to have to start saving again, as they do in China, as they do in Vietnam, as they do in India, as they do in every other country in the world. Somehow the American people thought that they were just going to be able to continue spending and living the good life forever. But there's no free lunch, and eventually comes payday, and we're going to have to pay, I'm afraid, very, very soon. Well, let's go to Steve, who's calling us from Illinois. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a question or comment?
Sure. Real fast, to Len Trees Forecasting, Bob Chapman. I've heard you on different programs. That appreciate your information. I thought it was kind of an eye-opener because it was said off the cuff for the most part on C-SPAN this weekend on Q&A. Or maybe it wasn't Q&A, but it was the other notes. But Jerry Edmonds was a speechwriter for the Clinton administration. And he happened to mention, like I say, off the cuff, that there were two speechwriter writing groups in the Clinton administration, one for domestic and one for foreign. And I thought that was, you know, sometimes you can tell forecasting by what's happened in the past. And I thought that was kind of an eye-opener that I just wonder of whom the people comprise the speechwriters for the foreign operations. Now, they can just about bet.
Okay, and, fine. Well, Steve, thank you very, so very much for
thank
calling.
Thank you very kindly, Doctor.
God bless. Bye-bye. And Chris, we have lots of problems. He was mentioning Sybil Edmonds. I hope our listeners will go up to my website. That's RadioLiberty.com, and of course we have a section on newsletters, and read about Sybil Edmonds. It's one of the most important stories. Why? Because Sybil worked for the FBI, found out that there was a spy ring operating at the highest levels of our government that was being covered for by our State Department. Of course, that's Council on Foreign Relations, and what were they up to? Why, of course, the spy ring was smuggling nuclear technology and nuclear material to Pakistan. It had been doing it for a long time so they could have their atom bombs, their nuclear bombs. Why would our government be encouraging that? Why, for the same reason that before the Second World War, we were building up Adolf Hitler. For the same reason during the Vietnam War, we were funding the communists in Russia so they could fund the communists in North Vietnam, so they could fund the Viet Cong, so we could have a war in South Vietnam. My fear is, of course, the next war will be a nuclear war, but we cannot let the American people know that. Read my newsletter, go up on the Internet, of course, punch in or Google in London Times and Sybil Edmonds, and you'll read the story. But, of course, nobody points out the fact that our government is actively encouraging the production of nuclear weapons in the Muslim world. Why would you do anything that stupid? They're not stupid. They're diabolical, but they're not stupid. Let's go right to Charles, who's calling from Harlem. Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
How are you today? Thank you, Dr. Stan, for your show, as always. And we call Bob Chapman in Harlem. We call him Uncle Bob.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to ask him a question about something I read in the International Forecaster. I'll get right to it. He talks about the, I guess it's a federal housing bill they're trying to pass or will pass. And one of the things he talked about was, and I wanted him to clarify, was how, and of course this will all come out of our pockets in the end, but he talks about how there are, well, I guess the best way to say it is there are, is a second chance for those who can't afford their homes, and there'll be, if they make a deal with the government, they'll have to give some of the equity back to the government in exchange for getting starting with a clean slate.
So
go
ahead with that, Bob. I think it's important. And basically, of course, we're talking about the housing bill. It's actually passed both houses. It's been signed by the president. It will soon be the law of the land. Bob, tell us about this housing bill and how it's going to impact on the listeners out there.
Well, one of the things they included was reporting all credit card transactions to the IRS.
Well, I'm sure that's why we have the housing crisis, is because we weren't sending all that information to the IRS so they could track every citizen in America. I feel so much safer now that everything that we do will be reported to the IRS as far as our purchases.
Well, what they're trying to do is net asset value everybody. They're trying to back into what they spend and what they make to see if they're making money that is not showing up. And so the way you befuddle the IRS and the government, if you choose to, is to do all business in cash and only use a card if you have one in emergencies. And so that kind of stops them at the pass. But essentially what it is, they're talking about a $50 billion problem.
You're talking $1 trillion, aren't you, rather than billion?
No, that's what they're talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
And they're talking about a max of $80 billion. When we know in the current coming fiscal year, they'll have to be talking $800 billion. And so I think the losses, when all is said and done, 3 to 4 or 5 years down the line here, will aggregate something in the vicinity of 2 to 3 trillion.
Okay, fine.
Fannie and Freddie,
right,
mind you.
Right. And of course, that'll be because their loans really are not solvent, and so they were going to lose that money instead of them losing it, or the bondholders, our friends in China or in Saudi Arabia losing the money, it's going to be taken out of the hides of the American taxpayers then.
That's right.
Well, could you explain explain for Charles how this is going to work? Certainly, is everybody who has a home in foreclosure going to be helped by this legislation?
Well, supposedly, but I don't think a lot of them will be. And even if they're helped, they still can't make the payments, most of them. They should have never had the homes in the first place. They should have stayed living in apartments or renting. And there's just no end to this problem. It's going to last for many years. If you were thinking of buying a home, don't. It's going to remain less expensive to rent and, you know, accumulate your money and buy gold and silver related assets with those funds. And down the line here, if we're right, maybe 3 years from now, you'll be able to go out and buy not the house you wanted, but a house that was worth twice that, and you'll be able to pay cash. And so be patient. Don't run into a maelstrom, because that's exactly what housing is. And, you know, historically, housing has never been an investment. It has always been a place where you lived. And if you kept it up, it retained its value. It's only since the Second World War in America that we have seen the outrageous gains in housing. And I'm a perfect example. I bought a house for $35,000 when I returned from Africa in 73. And I ended up in 1988 selling a house in Malibu that I had paid $230,000 for $1 million. I mean, that's how wacko it went. And, you know, I just get caught in the positive side of things, but those things shouldn't be happening. And they only could happen because of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the banks, the mortgage originators, and right down the line. And the whole thing was crazy, and we're going to pay for it big time. And it was deliberately created by the Fed as part of the scheme to bring America to its knees so they could shove world government down their throat.
And, of course, once, of course, our currency has been destroyed and our people have been impoverished, many of them will be willing to do whatever the government wants. That's the thing. When people lose everything they have, their life savings, their value of their insurance policy, their pensions, the pension funds are in real trouble across America. Not only that, but they're invested in stocks that are, of course, valued in American dollars. And American dollars is decreasing right now at the present time, according to Bob, over 13%, and will soon be decreasing at 16 or 17%. There's no better way to destroy a nation than to debase its currency. And there's not one person in a million who will understand what's going on. At least that's what Alan Greenspan quoted Lenin as saying, Alan Greenspan's book, The Age of Turbulence. People must understand they knew what they were doing. They've debauched our currency intentionally. They're not stupid. They just expect that we'll be stupid. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I was watching a clip on television or on a video of a congressman saying, look, this housing bill's only going to help about 5% of the people. Do you think that was an exaggeration, Bob? Do you think it'll help the majority of the people, you know, who are having trouble, maintaining their ownership of their homes?
It might help 100,000 people.
100,000 people. That's about what I figured.
And they're talking a half a million.
Right.
And they're talking about quality people, people who should have had homes, people who have good credit, people who had the values of their homes drop, or a lender just won't make another loan. Not because there's anything wrong with the borrower or the property. They just won't do it.
Well, of course,
I'm seeing the same thing in business loans.
And, of course, basically what's happening is that homes are losing their value. And, of course, if you have a mortgage for $500,000 and the house is only worth $350,000, are you going to continue paying on that mortgage? And I don't think most people would do that. They've used their homes as a piggy bank. And of course, and now comes the day of reckoning when, of course, all that money they've borrowed and spent, and then it has no basis at all because their house is not worth that, and they're going to have to keep making the payments on their home, even though the house is worth far less, and of course than the mortgage is outstanding. So we've got
over the next 5 years, we're faced with the option arm loans, which are called pick and pay loans.
Why don't you explain to our listeners what that is?
Well, what it is that they tack on to the back of the loan principal that should be paid that isn't, and they just charge you a small fee. In other words, you might have a home with the payment over a five-year period should have been perhaps $7,000 a month, but you've been paying $1,000. And all of that is tacked on to the back of the loan. And then you come up to reset that loan, and the house that you bought for $200,000, or let's say $400,000, is now the note on it is $450,000, and the house may be worth $350,000. And even if it's worth $450,000, they can't get a loan anyway. And that's what the government wants to solve, because they believe that these people will pay the loans. And generally speaking, normally they would. But this is not a normal time, and there's lots of layoffs, and there's going to be a lot more over the next 3 to 5 years. And then you have these 5 years of these pick and pays coming due, which is going to exacerbate the situation that government just doesn't want to understand. Never mind all of the loans that we're experiencing now that are going bad, which are the subprime and ALTA loans. And the worst of that will be over by next June. But as I said, we've got the other group coming, which is actually far bigger than the first two groups. So this is not going to go away. And what they're doing for Fannie and Freddie is not going to solve the problem. And it's just going to extend it into the future so that these elitists can buy time. and we get to pay for it.
Amen to that. It could be a very, very expensive purchase that we've just made. The debt of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that could be, of course, $2 to $3 trillion added onto the rest of our debt. Well, let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Watsonville. Hi, Kevin. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, good evening, Dr. Stan and Mr. Chapman. My question has to do with the central bank's allotment of selling the gold. I think it's 500 tons a year, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes,
I think
that's the European Central Bank's, and the figure is 500.
Okay, and my question is, I read an article that they were holding back, or not holding back, but they still had a, I don't know if it was 170 or 270 tons remaining, and it expires August 15th. And I guess my question is that something that they would hold to dump on the market, you know, to do a short-term manipulation, or do you think that they're getting to a point where they want to hang on to their reserves more? There's only a few weeks till that date. And
I find it, we're just running out of time. Bob?
Yeah.
It's the end of the fiscal year, which is the 30th of September.
30th.
So we've got 2 months. And I think if they wanted to sell, they would have sold.
Okay.
To suppress prices. So I don't think you're going to see a bulge at the end. The only group that I could see being a seller would be France. And they've been a steady seller. And in the figures is 257 to go.
Okay, yeah, that's a lot for a short period of time. So.
Well, they understand.
No, we don't even know whether they got gold. We know France has it. Most of them don't have it.
Okay, we're good.
Reading some articles where some of the gold was falling apart even in some of the storages.
Hold that right there, Kevin. Okay, Kevin, you were saying you were hearing that some of the gold was falling apart.
It was not pure gold.
It was obviously an amalgam of some sort. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there were supposed to be gold bars in there. I think it was one of the African central bank storages or something. And they had noticed that that it was actually starting to flake on them and crack and stuff, which gold bars aren't supposed to do. But
you want to comment on that, Bob?
Yeah, it was the Bank of England. And the bars were cast in the 1840s and 50s, so they used too much alloy in them, and they probably weren't a good delivery anyway. And this delivery problem has cropped up over the last couple of years. And yes, England had some gold like that, but not a lot of it. But the United States has a lot of it, 88-90%, because they melted a lot of coins in the 1930s, and they had that in storage, and that has come out onto the market, and we're the only ones that had that sort of thing. And so I think the U.S. may very well be out of gold.
Yes.
And we don't know because we haven't had a audit since 1954.
Right. There's no transparency yet there.
Right. And of course, banks are leasing gold, which is really tantamount to selling it, but they can keep it on the books as still having it. And we don't know, because it's a secret, how much gold has been leased out. And we're supposed to find out from the IMF in June, but of course we didn't.
Right.
And so I think that the gold position is much, much smaller in central banks than what we're led to believe. In fact, I think they're down probably to about 5,000 tons that they want to sell, and that's not very much.
No, that could go pretty quick. Appreciate your input, and appreciate your show, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Thanks very much, Kevin. Appreciate it. Hope you get everybody over there in Watsonville listening.
Okay.
Good night. God bless.
All right.
Okay, fine. That was Kevin calling from Watsonville, and we're just about out of time. Do you want to go ahead and get your website and your telephone number out one more time?
Sure. The website is theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternationalforecaster.com. The email address is international_forecaster@yahoo.com, international_forecaster@yahoo.com, and the toll-free number is 800-375-4188. 800-375-4188.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. God bless. Talk to you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here. And, of course, if you'd like to get in touch with Bob, his website, International forecaster at yahoo.com, the international forecaster at yahoo.com. The telephone number is, of course, 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And, of course, we receive no compensation for putting Bob Chapman on. We just think his information is fascinating. I look forward to reading his newsletter. It comes twice a week, and believe me, it keeps you pretty busy. But information you're not going to get elsewhere. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're in terrible straits financially. If you want to understand money, we have two little pamphlets, compilations of our newsletters. One is called The History of Money. The other is called The Financial Meltdown. The Financial Meltdown. And we are in a financial meltdown, and the economy is simply contracting rapidly here in America and all across the world. And this is what's happened time and again throughout history when countries have gone into fiat money systems. And of course, what's the solution? The economy is collapsing. We'll print more money. Then we'll print more money. We'll print more money. And the Democrats now want another financial stimulus. They're talking about giving out another $50 billion. We gave out $168 billion at the beginning of this year, and it kept the economy going. Let's get some more money. Where is it coming from? A debt? Well, we have so much debt today, we're pushing well over $9 trillion, $9.5 trillion in debt. We'll soon be at $10 trillion in debt, and then we have another $40 or $50 trillion in obligations, money we promised. There's no money there. And the only way out of this mess is simply to destroy the value of currency and to pay it back with worthless dollars. That's a wonderful way to do it. And the people will get their money, it just won't buy anything. Remember, we installed Mugabe in Rhodesia today. The inflation rate in Rhodesia is 2.5 million percent, 2.5 million percent a year. And, of course, has devastated that nation. And we're not going to be too far behind that unless, of course, the American people wake up and change our leadership. And believe me, both McCain and Obama are controlled by exactly the same people. And it doesn't make a dime's worth of difference which one you get in as far as the financial future of this country. So it's about time you begin doing your research and find out what's really going on. And of course, we hope that you'll want to get my talk on the financial tsunami and the syllabus that goes with that. That's the financial tsunami, the syllabus that goes with it, the book The Creature from Jekyll Island by our good friend Ed Griffin. That's The Creature from Jekyll Island. The book The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, going into the background of what's going on there and as far as the Federal Reserve System. A privately owned central bank created by the bankers for the bankers to enrich the bankers and impoverish the people, and they're doing a great job of it. And then, of course, the book Fiat Money Inflation in France. If you get those that information, you will know more than most college graduates in economics, and you'll understand what's happening today, what happens to any nation that takes out a fiat money system and relies upon men to solve the problem. Of course, the people who are actually trying to solve the problem are the people who created the problem. And giving more money to the Federal Reserve to solve the problem they created is not going to solve anything. But it is going to simply lead to inflation and the destruction of everything that our listeners have worked for, their pensions, their insurance policies, their annuities, their life savings, their CDs, their bank deposits, anything mediated in dollars is going to be destroyed before this is over. And you need to understand what's going on. You need to begin making preparations fiscally, materially, and spiritually for the difficult times that lie ahead. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com. Go there. You can read our newsletters. You can certainly listen to our radio programs free. We have a 24-hour feed up to a satellite, and we have archive programs. We have MP3 radio programs. And then, of course, you can go back and you can look at the videos we have. And then we have another section on other videos. We hope you'll go there. Fascinating, links to other important websites. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Whale. This is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Barry Samish. And Barry said an Israeli patriot. Actually, he's fluent in a number of languages. He, of course, was an investigative reporter in Israel for a number of years, and I guess pretty close to 30 years, wasn't it, Barry?
31 plus,
but because of course, threats on his life, he came to America, and, of course, that's our advantage because we have a chance, of course, to have an opportunity to get the benefit of his knowledge of the history of what's going on in Israel and the fact that there are some very wicked people in positions of power over there. And, of course, you know, from a Christian point of view, and those of you who don't know, I'm an evangelical Christian, why, of course, what happens in the Near East and in the Middle East will have a direct impact upon America. And I believe that some of the most exciting events of the last several hundred years are going to be occurring in that part of the world in the very near future. So with that as a background, well, I don't know whether Barry's going to be able to talk to us and tell us the story of the Holocaust, the story you have never heard before, or what we talk about tonight, Barry?
Yeah, I prepared it for you.
All right, fine. You go ahead.
Look, it's a very confusing and remarkable story, and I'm going to try and make it understandable to an audience that's never heard it before. And we've already gone and discussed, I believe on this station as well, the Sabbateans. We discussed that last week, right?
Well, why don't you just pray very briefly for our listeners who don't know who the Sabbateans are, because most people have never heard of the Sabbateans. They don't know anything about this sect of Judaism. So pick the story up.
It's not a sect of Judaism
It's a sect that is attributed to Judas, but these are people who have turned against Judaism, isn't it?
Well, they've infiltrated Judaism, and they're destroying Judaism, and they've been at it for... since the birth of Shabtai Tzvi, not the birth, the day he declared he was the Messiah of the Jews, June 18, 1666, this horrible sect they're anti-Jews.
All right, fine. They're anti-Jews, but they were people really of Jewish extraction, weren't they, Lars?
Well, originally.
Right.
Now, this, I've got to... just cut this down, and you've got to get my books, or I guess the archive of last week's show might be up on your website. It'll be on mine already.
All right.
Look, the Sabbateans marry outside Judaism, as a rule. Some stay within Judaism, others don't, but largely they do their damage when they're Muslims or Catholic or Protestant, but they're practicing Sabbateanism, well, let's just say on the weekends. In short, there are people with Jewish backgrounds who hate Jews. And if you don't accept Shabtai Tzvi, and later it was Jacob Frank, of course, as the Messiah, well, you just die. It's that simple. And this is a blessing. To kill a Jew who doesn't accept Shabbat Tzvi as the Messiah is a blessing. Okay, now this is background information. Now let's talk about the war. Are we ready?
All right, you go right ahead. For our listeners, Sabbati was the man, S-A-B-A-T-T-I. And, of course, Sabbateanism is Sabbat, S-A-B-B-A-T-A-N-I-S-M. Is that pretty close to it?
Well, there's a lot of spellings. His name was Shabtai.
All right.
And in Hebrew, there's Shabbat. Shabbatai. Well, let's see, Shabbatut. It doesn't matter.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here with Barry Samish. All right, Barry, go ahead. Pick the story up.
All right. Now, let's look at the full background of the Holocaust. First, the people fighting the war. Now, we've already done this, that Winston Churchill was a Jew. And you know what? People don't get this, but his mother was an American, daughter of a stockbroker. Her name was Jenny Jerome. Winston Churchill's mother was a Jew. By Jewish law, Winston Churchill was a Jew. In case people didn't understand that fact, he was a Jew. And, well, he was only one of the main characters with his Jewish background. We know the story of Hitler. I've explained it before. It was on the History Channel in the year 2005 that the first act that Hitler did after taking Austria was to send a few bulldozers to his birthplace to level the town, according to the History Channel, to wipe out his Jewish roots. Now, without giving theories that the mother was working in a Rothschild home and had a Rothschild baby, all this stuff, it doesn't matter. The fact is that Hitler felt he had Jewish roots, and he had them destroyed. Now that's Hitler and Churchill. Now let's get on to FDR. What you should know about FDR is the Roosevelts were Jewish Dutch. When they arrived in New York City in 1682, their name was, in fact, Rosenvelt. And the first Roosevelt was Nicholas, again, Rosenvelt. Next, FDR's mother was Sarah Delano, who was a Sephardic Jew. She was descended from Sephardic Jews. Whether she, in fact, believed it, recognized it, it's irrelevant, really. FDR was a Sabbatean. He was deeply Jewish on both sides of his family. Now we go to Stalin. And this, you know, I've known this all my life, but I started digging up things for the show. Stalin's original name was Yosef David Djukashvili, which translated from the original Georgian Russian means son of a Jew. That was Stalin's real name. Now, again... Well,
Barry, I want you to hold that for just a moment as right? We bring other stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, as we said, Barry is an Israeli patriot, but he's very concerned about the Sabbatean influence that, of course, pretends to be Jewish, but really isn't, but it works. And of course, this is why there's so many people who are anti-Semitic. It's because they see what the Sabbateans are doing and thinks this has something to do with Judaism, which it does not. And Barry was pointing out the fact that if you go into the background of Adolf Hitler, you go into the background of Winston Churchill, if you go into the background of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they all came from this Jewish Sabbatean background. But go ahead, pick the story up from there.
Again, you know, it's strange about Sabbateanism. You don't have to be practicing it. It's a very strange trait. Did Winston Churchill actually practice Sabbateanism? I would say no, but he sure did not admit ever in his life that his mother was Jenny Jerome, a New York Jew.
Of course, he was a Druid, though. He was deeply involved in the occult, which may very well explain what he did. And the relationship between the occult and Sabbateanism is very strong. But pick up the story.
That would be extremely relevant.
Right.
Well, we've gone through now FDR. The Roosevelt's original name was Rosenvelt, and they were Jewish when they arrived in New York. His mother was Sarah Delano, who was, of course, descended from Sephardic Jews. Joseph Stalin's real name was Joseph David Djukashvili, meaning son of a Jew. But more to the point, he married three women. They were all Jewish. All his children are Jewish. Now, if anyone thinks that Stalin was in any way a friend of the Jews, just remember, as he was dying, he was planning to get, really, it was originally called the doctor's coup, where 11 doctors were going to be put on trial and this trial would be used as a pretext to wipe out Russian Jews. This is Stalin. He was Jewish, and his children are Jewish. But one last name before we dive into the Holocaust. That's the winning general, Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower's father was a Swedish Jew. And in the West Point yearbook of 1915, it was pointed out that Eisenhower's father was a Jew. The fact of the matter is there are just too many of these leaders who have not just Jewish background. Come on. Churchill's mother was Jewish. Stalin himself, whatever he practiced, apparently was a Jew. Why are they all fighting the Holocaust? Why are they all, well, first of all, in Hitler's case, killing the Jews. In Stalin's case, later he would have perpetrated a Russian Holocaust. He was planning that. In FDR's case, why did he stay out along with Churchill and let them kill the Jews? This story has never been properly told, that the people fighting the war were actually letting the Jews get wiped out.
In fact, of course, the Jews who tried to get on boats and come to the United States or to Great Britain from Germany, they were turned back. They weren't allowed to come to the United States. They weren't allowed to go into England. And that doesn't make sense. I mean, why weren't they welcomed here in this country? And it was because they were being sent back to die.
Well, that's certainly the story. And we've covered that, but now I'm going to dive deeper. Now, I'm going to start with why the American Jews didn't react to the Holocaust. And that's a very serious subject. American Jews are not reacting to the plight of Israel right now. None of them. They're going on with their own egotistical little lives, and they're letting Israel go down the drain. Now, just so you know, I did two lectures in Atlanta last week, good lectures, at synagogues, where for the first time in a synagogue, I let loose with this Sabbatean stuff. About a third of the audience left. The rest stayed to the end with lots of questions, but the Jews don't want to hear this. Well, I hope there's some Jews listening tonight because they're going to hear it. Remember, we're talking about the late 30s through the 40s, leading the Jewish community in the United States. The most influential people were Jacob Schiff and Max Warburg. Now, I don't want to dive too heavily into the Rothschilds and how Sabbatean they were. This is the time. Schiff was, and Warburg were both originally, the families were from Frankfurt. They were sent to America in the mid-19th century by Rothschild. That's background. By the way, you have to get my book, Sabbatean Free Labor Zionism and the Holocaust, to get all these little facts. But they were major influences on the American Jewish community during the Holocaust. They both came from Kuhn Leb, a stockbroking firm in New York City. What makes that very important is that Max Warburg was the nephew of Felix Warburg. Felix Warburg put millions and millions of dollars into the Russian Revolution. Okay, by the way, you know what, I'll do my story. Get my book, you'll get the sources. I don't want to stop and give sources every time. But Kuhn Leb and Felix Warburg made sure the Russians went communist. Okay, go and figure that out. There are reasons. A lot of it is just pure repression, but they were the leaders, two of the major leaders of the Jewish community during the Holocaust who prevent American intervention. And, of course, the Warburgs were the banker of Hitler. And, you know, I read the book. I don't know if it's even out there anymore. But I read the book. It was printed in 1946 or 7, right after the war. by Sidney Warburg. And it just exposed how his family, he was sent to the court of Hitler to arrange financing for the Nazi dictator. And what can you say about the Warburgs? They backed both the Russian Revolution, Stalin, and Hitler. They backed them both with their money. All right? Just keep that in mind. And there's one hint of why. James Warburg, U.S., was interrogated by the U.S. Senate in 1950. And he just said, there's going to be a world government. Whether the people want it or don't want it, there's going to be a world government.
I think he used the term either by conquest or consent, something
like that. Very good, my boy, yes. I was going to open my, yes, I was going to open my book and give the actual quote.
Okay.
Yes, that's James Warburg.
Right.
So you're familiar with the Warburg family during the war, then?
Oh, yes, but I want you to tell the story. You tell it far better than I do.
I don't know about that. Well, you got the quote right. Now, that's the Warburg side. Other Jews who were involved... I got to mention the Schiff side as well. Because, remember, they were the Bronfmans, or they were Ronald Lauder, or they were Mortimer Zuckerman of the 30s and 40s. They were the unelected leaders of American Jewry. They leaned on Roosevelt. They leaned on the Congress. And they leaned to make sure the Jews of Europe died. Now, of the Schiff family, Jacob Schiff's father, John Jacob Schiff, worked with E.H. Harriman to acquire the Union Pacific Railroad in 1897. Let me explain a little bit about E.H. Harriman. E.H. Harriman was a Boston financial firm. How influenced by the Schiff's beyond the railroad acquisition, they acquired 20% of it. Somebody else will have to dive into. But Harriman and Company was the employer of Prescott Bush, by far Adolf Hitler's leading American donor. Individual donor was Prescott Bush. This president's grandfather was the leading American backer of Hitler. All right, how is this for a lineup already of the families, leading American Jewry? These are the people who are going to prevent the Holocaust. You have that chance of that when they're funneling between the Warburgs and the Schiffs. They're funneling to Hitler all the money he needs to stay alive. And by the way, in the final segment of the show, I will return to the Israeli contribution to the Holocaust, but I want to start with the American. Now, what we're dealing with right now is another Jew. That is Chief Justice Felix Frankfurter. And by the way, when your name is Frankfurter, you came from Frankfurt, the home of Jacob, Frank, and the Rothschilds, and Adam Weishaupt. Justice Felix Frankfurter, was very proud because on his wall was a portrait of Eva Frank. And again, that is Jacob Frank, the second false messiah after Shabtai Tzvi. That was his wife.
And of course, he lived about, in the late 1800s and was very, very close to the Rothschild and to Adam Weishaupt. Is that right?
The year was 1786.
Right. Well, that's pretty close. Okay. Go right ahead.
Oh, I heard music.
You do? And, we're just going to have to hold up. We'll be back here in just a moment with Barry Shamus. And these are the things you're not going to hear elsewhere because... basically, of course, these people are not Jewish. They claim to be Jewish, but they hate Jews. And this is, of course, what people really don't understand. They're Sabbateans. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, just taking the Schiff family as an example, Schiff's, John Jacob Schiff's grandson is married to Al Gore's daughter, which, again, in my book, Schweigs Wie Leben Sein ist the Holocaust, I have a very fine scholar from Oxford University, Avraham Ehrlich, who just says to me outright, this is a giveaway that Gore is a Sabbatean as well. Believe me, when you start thinking in terms of Jews who are no longer Jews, there isn't a Schiff in America who is a Jew anymore. They're all Protestants of one denomination or another. And it goes on. There's no Bronfman now. The Bronfman kids are Catholic. They don't stay Jewish, and yet they seem to really be in the affairs of Israel and the affairs of the people, and that's what the Sabbateans do. Benjamin Disraeli was a typical Sabbatean. He told everyone he was an Anglican, but in fact was very proud, he said, of his Jewish roots, but he was an Anglican. That is what Sabbateans do. They pretend they're something else. Now, as for Warburg and Frankfurter, Max Warburg handled the president. And the president, over and over again, said the same thing. We can't do anything. Max Warburg said we can't do anything. It's hopeless in Europe. When there was a group of Orthodox rabbis, just like today, the Orthodox are all on their own and they have no voice. But they're right. They organized a large march in Washington. Orthodox Jews from all over America with the beards and the black coats and the black hats strolled through the streets of Washington, and Max Warburg persuaded Roosevelt that they weren't important enough to meet. They only want to save their friends and relatives and their people in Europe. Why should Roosevelt even meet them? That was Max Warburg who arranged that. And Felix Frankfurter, well, he made sure the Supreme Court never intervened on behalf of the Jews dying in Europe. And I, again, interviews I have in my books said the same thing. The court were very sympathetic to the Jews, but because Felix Frankfurter said nothing could be done, they did nothing.
And what a great tragedy.
That's putting it mildly. But I'm going to go on. I have kind of a cold, you can hear, I'm sure.
You're doing fine, Barry. Go right ahead.
Right. Now, what we're going to do is the worst of the lot, truly the worst of the lot. He was the head of the Reform movement. Now, we've done this on the show, that the Reform were founded in Germany, went to England, and then off to America. The reason the Reform and the Conservative exist is to dilute Judaism and really make sure that this generation of Jews really don't believe in God. Okay? They don't, the Reform synagogue is an atrocity. They teach that the Bible was man-written.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney Barry was simply talking about the conservative and the reform branches of Judaism. He feels that they're there to dilute Judaism. And of course, he believes that the keepers of the faith, of the Israeli faith, of the Jewish faith, of the Orthodox Jews, the ones with the black hats and the beards. But of course, certainly when they were demonstrating during the period of the Second World War, prior to the Second World War, to try to do something to keep the Holocaust from destroying the Jews of Europe, why, of course, there were some of the Sabbateans having the ear of the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, saying, don't even meet with the Orthodox, they're unimportant, there's nothing we can do to stop what's going on in Europe, there's nothing we can do to save the Jews. These were people who most people think of as Jews, but they were not. They were Sabbateans who hate Jews. And yet, of course, they hide behind their Jewish names. And go right ahead, pick up the story there.
Well, we're off to the Stephen Wise, who was the head of the Reform movement, and he was You know, I don't know what his position was for the American Jewish Committee, AJC, but he was certainly on it. Now, I'm going to turn to Rabbi Marvin Antleman, very good writer. He wrote the book, the two volumes, called To Eliminate the Opiate. Try and find them. That's all I can say. Rabbi Marvin Antleman, To Eliminate the Opiate on the Sabbateans. Of Stephen Wise, Marvin Antleman writes, there was a book by one Helen Rawlinson. It was called Stranger at the Party. She had a sex affair with Rabbi Wise. He puts Rabbi in quotation marks on his desk, on his actual desk. And while it was going on, Rabbi Stephen Wise was repeating the Sabbatean prayer for intercourse, which to Rabbi Antleman was just a giveaway of who he was. Nonetheless, with that in mind, let's look at what he did. After the Kristallnacht in 1938, when, if you don't know what it is, the Nazis destroyed Jewish property throughout Germany. Kristallnacht is the Crystal Night. The Jews were furious. And on AJC paper, Stephen Wise said, no reaction. We will not react to the Kristallnacht. Because the Kristallnacht was one more act, and we'll talk about this shortly, of the transfer agreement to make the Jews so frightened that they would go to Israel. Believe it or not, the Nazis were working with the Zionists, the labor Zionists, and we'll get to that. Now, of Stephen Wise, I'll just go over a few of his beauties. In 1942, a report on the full Holocaust was sent to the State Department that the mass executions had begun. Wise ordered it kept secret. Don't ask why. Don't ask where he had the power to do this. The actual Holocaust was not reported in the American media until Dwight Eisenhower stepped into an actual Holocaust camp. For 3 years, there were no reports on the Holocaust, and Stephen Wise was the reason for that. Now, there's a. I'm going to actually quote him right now. I'm getting out my little book because this quote is just appalling. After the Kristallnacht, New York Senator Wagner introduced legislation to allow 20,000 German Jewish children into the United States. And who wouldn't? Well, Stephen Wise testified before the legislation committee and stopped the legislation. 20,000 dead Jews because of Stephen Wise. Here is his testimony to Congress. Quote, if there is any conflict between our duty to those children and our duty to our country comes first. And if the children cannot be helped, they will die. Can you believe that statement?
How can I believe it? We're dealing with wicked people. When you understand that, all these terrible things that have taken place really make sense. Go right ahead.
Oh, that doesn't make sense to me. You can't say the children will die.
Well, of course, but he did say that. He said that because he had no concern, he had no human compassion. And this, of course, is so typical of these people who believe to organizations such as this, as the Sabbateans. We're going to be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish, and we're talking about this organization. Most people have never heard of the Sabbateans. They're very real. They exist. They existed, and they exist today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barry Shamish. Barry, go right ahead.
Have you ever heard of Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells?
Sure have, right.
Really? It was through him that Wise kept the Holocaust report a secret during the summer of 1942 until the camps were liberated. News of the Holocaust was not in the American media because Wise worked with one Sumner Wells to keep the report secret.
In fact, Sumner Wells was working with the Nazis even and wrote a book about 42 or 43 talking about the Nazi secret plan after the war had ended and had lost, but eventually to create a secret society by which, you know, two generations later the Nazis would control the world. And well, they've done a pretty good job of it, but most people have never heard of that. But Wells was very close to the Nazis.
Unbelievable. I appreciate this a lot. When I wrote this book, I didn't know who Sumner Wells was. I just know that he was working with Stephen Wise to make sure the Jews died. And according to Wise, the only way to save the Jews is to unite the Jewish people behind the victory program of President Roosevelt. No bombing Auschwitz, nothing practical. We're just going to win the war and we'll save the Jews. Of all the Jews where the Nazis were, 6 million died and 100,000 survived. It was a real good, really a terrific plan. Now, just so you know, not all the Jews were Sabbateans. Henry Morgenthau, what do you know about him?
Well, he was a Secretary of the Treasury, as I remember, wasn't he?
Well, indeed he was. Wise felt strongly that the Gillette legislation did not provide proper commission. In other words, there was a good congressman, Congressman Gillette, who tried to save the remnants of the Jews, and Wise stopped them. So Henry Morgenthau summoned his aide, Joshua Dubois, to uncover the State Department's policy vis-a-vis the Jewish rescue in Europe. And the stunning title to the Dubois Memorandum was Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of this Government in the Murder of Jews.
Well, that is rather a devastating thought. But, of course, it's the truth of the matter is our government did go along with it, just as it's going along with it, so many of the other atrocities. But the American people have never been allowed to know.
Well, the horrible, horrible...
Hold that for just a moment. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Barry. Our guest is Barry Shamish, and he's just been telling us about the complicity of the American government during the Second World War and people like Henry Morgenthau in allowing the Holocaust to take place. This is why they wouldn't let the Jews come to America. They wouldn't let the Jewish children come to America. They refused to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz. They refused to bomb Auschwitz. They refused to do anything to help the Jews, knowing full well they would be slaughtered there. Now, before we go on, Barry, I do want you to get out your website. I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your books and how they can get your DVDs, and then we'll get back to this incredible story of the Holocaust, the untold story.
Well, first of all, Henry Morgenthau was a good guy. He wanted to get to the bottom of why the Jews weren't being rescued, and he had that report on the acquiescence to the murder of the Jews written. So leave Morgenthau out of this. He was a good guy. The bad guys were Max Warburg, Jacob Schiff, Felix Frankfurter, and Stephen Wise, amongst others, were the Jews working on the Roosevelt government to make sure no attempt whatsoever was made to rescue the Jews of Europe. So it's not a simple story, and as I said, I'm taking a quote here and a quote there, but you're right, I have books. The most prominent books of mine on the Holocaust are Save Israel and Shabbat Free Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. You get them by going to www.lulu.com. That is lulu.com. You'll see a box in the right-hand corner. It says search. Write in my name. C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's Shamish, and they'll get to my books. The website is www.barrychamish.com, and I'll leave a phone number. I have an audio DVD just made called Shabtai's Tzvi Lieber Zionism and the Holocaust. And I'm going to have, for my speeches in Atlanta, I had two people videotaping them, and they will be sending me a new DVD called Shabtai's Tzvi Lieber Zionism and the Holocaust. It's about this very, very speech, and the audio one you can have already by phoning me. It's not on Lulu. You dial 904-315-8079. That's 904-315-8079. And back to the Holocaust.
Okay, go right, go for it here.
Well, I think we can, I think we can lay off the Americans. I want to get to the Israelis. The Sabbateans who ran Israel did a terrifically awful number. Just keep in mind that the Israeli Jewish leadership, I'm sorry, back in 1938, throughout the Holocaust, there was no Israeli Jewish leadership. Let's just say the American Jewish leadership and the upcoming Israeli Jewish leadership, known as the Palestinian Jewish leadership back then, we'll talk about shortly, but every effort was made to make sure the Jews died. And it wasn't an accident. This is what I try and explain, and people don't understand this. The Jewish people have been infiltrated by people who get tremendous energy. Rabbi Antelman calls the Holocaust a burnt offering. To them, it was a wonderful celebration because these Jews believed in the Torah. And Israel was being set up as a Sabbatean state, and nobody wanted these Jews. Now, I'm going to dive in to the Israeli side of things. Or back then, of course, Palestinian Jewry, whatever they called it. The Jewish Agency of Jerusalem. You know, there's a guy named Simon Wiesenthal, who Jews thought was doing the Nazi hunting for them. He didn't get one major Nazi, not a one. Israel only convicted one Nazi, Adolf Eichmann. In all Israel's long history, with tens of thousands of butchers out there, they managed to convict one Nazi. They were not going to chase Nazis. What Wiesenthal did was an utter sham, and people don't understand this. Wiesenthal died age 95, a hero for chasing Nazis. He was chasing minor, useless bureaucrats. The big ones got away, well, of course, through the Vatican rat lines. But let us begin with the transfer agreement. This was the atrocity of the Jewish Agency of Jerusalem, led by Chaim Weizmann, cutting a deal with the Nazis. Now, there's a book by Edwin Black called The Transfer Agreement. It's a difficult read, but get it. If you can, get it. What the transfer agreement stated, it was being negotiated, by the way, in 1933, was that the Jews of Jerusalem wanted the Jews of Germany as seed stock for a new Sabbatean nation. To get their way, they cut a deal with the Hitler regime that if you make life so miserable for the Jews of Germany, and they arrive in what would become Israel, they would buy only German goods with their money, and we would stop all economic embargoes and boycotts of the Nazis worldwide. We'd give you a carte blanche to exist. Without the Zionists, the Nazis would have fallen. They didn't have the power to go on. And the Jewish boycotts worldwide were having their effect. it was the Jewish agency run by the labor Zionists who propped up the Nazis. And in return, they got between 70 and 80,000 German Jews sent to them between 1933 and 1939 when the British closed the borders of Palestine to the Jews and left the, as the war started, of course, and left the Jews of Europe to be fried, to be gassed, to be burned. It's a god-awful story. Now, there was a group of Jews who tried to stop it. They were the good Zionists, the ones I related to, the revision Zionists led by Zev Jabotinsky. There was a conference in Prague in 1933 that he almost got the transfer agreement canceled. But here's what stopped, here's what let the injustice go on. There was a murder in Tel Aviv of someone named Chaim Arlozorov. He was the Jewish agency's negotiator with the Nazis of the transfer agreement. Now, this murder, by the way, was every bit as big as Rabin's. In Israeli folklore, it's the equivalent of the Rabin murder. It's still spoken of and argued about today who did it. Naturally, like the Rabin murder, the right-wing revisionists, today it would be called Likuds, in those days the revisionists or Herut, were blamed for the murder. They arrested three of them, and of course they didn't do it. But in Prague, there was the Zionist conference, World Zionist Conference. The Jabotinsky Herut group were trying to stop the atrocity of the transfer agreement, which meant that Germany and the labor Zionists were working to establish a Sabbatean state in Israel with the rest of European Jewry wiped out because they did not want the Jews who believed in God or the Torah. They wanted to start a new Judaism using German stock. They were every bit as racist as the Nazis were in their own way. Well, at the Prague conference, what happened is on the podium, a little piece of paper was shoved around. Everyone looked shocked. The podium closed down. The rumor spread that it was proof that Jabotinsky ordered the murder of Arlozorov. The next day, they threw Jabotinsky and the Herut out of the Zionist movement, and the labor Zionists took over, and their transfer agreement went through, and the founders of Israel founded their state with the Nazis. That's a true story, by the way. It's awful as it sounds. It's actually a true story. And to let you know just how involved they were in the Holocaust, in 1936, Chaim Weizmann spoke at the Zionist Conference. That year, I believe it was in Basel, Switzerland, and he gave this. He was applauded for this. He gave this speech that 2 million Jews may survive the Holocaust. He called it the Holocaust. He said there is no room for the old in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. We will try and save the young. The old Jews will enter the dustbin of history. That is a quote. Weizmann knew the Holocaust was going to take place in 1936. He was head of the Jewish agency. And the first president of Israel, a big shot, and he was a butcher. Just so you know, he was a butcher.
Well, I think that there's some terrible, terrible things that happened. But you see, most people don't understand. I don't think even most Jews understand this, do they?
No. No, most Jews think Weizenthal was got the Balfour Agreement by inventing this way of turning peeling paint into acetone. There is so much mythology and nonsense surrounding Chaim Weizmann. There are no words to describe how much. No, the Jews don't know.
All right, fine. Well, you go ahead and let's get as much of the story in as we can. So basically, of course, you've got the transfer agreement. You've got the atrocities. You know, everything's planned ahead of time, and the Jews are simply being set up to be slaughtered with the help of these other Sabbateans.
Yes. They may not have pulled the trigger, but they also didn't drive the rescue trucks. Now, I'm going to turn to that marvelous book, Perfidy, by Ben Hecht.
Right. And he was Jewish, and yet he was trying to tell a lot of this story, wasn't he?
Well, afterwards, the book wasn't written until 1962.
Right.
But during the Holocaust, the revisionists led by, Ben Hecht was certainly amongst them, Peter Cook, there was a group trying their darndest to get the Jews saved, but they were, the labor Zionists made them out to be fanatics. That's the way history is written. They do this all the time, these labor Zionists. They're letting the Jews of Europe get gassed, and they're taking the group that wants to save them and turning them into fascists. Ben-Gurion used to call Jabotinsky Adolf Jabotinsky. Okay? This is the way they do it. The same thing with the Rabin murder. The right wing were, of course, the fascists who killed their hero Rabin, when, in fact, Rabin was murdered by Shimon Peres. And there's ample proof of that. They write the history, and in their history, the right wing are fascists and do the killing. The real truth is the left wing do the killing, and they let the Jews of Europe die, and we have proof of that in Ben Hecht wrote a book called Perfidy that was so well written that it exposed a lot of these left-wing so-called labor Zionist atrocities. Now, the first thing we must talk about is what the book was about. There was a journalist, Malkiel Greenwald, who really, me and him must have had a lot in common. He had a little broadsheet, no internet back there, and he distributed it, and he claimed that someone from the Jewish agency working for Chaim Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, named Rudolf Kastner, went to Hungary, where 800,000 Jews remained, to negotiate the saving of the Hungarian Jews. And what Malkiel Greenwald wrote was that he became good friends with Adolf Eichmann, and he saved about 3,500 Sabbateans and members of his family and let Eichmann get rid of the rest. Eichmann didn't want to murder the Jews. He knew the war was finished. He just wanted to get rid of the Jews. And he gave Kastner, and by the way, more than Kastner, but he gave him an opportunity. I believe the number was 10,000 trucks, non-military. A lot of it was just to ship loot out of Hungary, where it would be startup funds for Adolf Eichmann. Well, needless to say, it didn't get off the ground. Every Jew, 800,000 of them, could have been saved if Eichmann was paid with a few non-military trucks. But he wasn't. Now, a rabbi named Rabbi Yoel Brand wrote about his adventure. He went to Aleppo, Syria, to meet with Israel's second prime minister. He was second in the Jewish agency, Moshe Sharet, and offer him the truck deal. Sharet told the British to arrest Brand, and he was thrown into prison until the war ended. And later on, he wrote a book about the treason of the labor Zionists. We have many sources for the truck deal. Eichmann offered a way to save all the Jews. That's simple. And Kastner turned him down. Now, we look at the book Perfidy. How much time do we have?
Well, we've got about three or four minutes.
All right, I'll rush this a little bit then. I'm glad to know that. According to perfidy, do I hear music?
You hear it? Go ahead. The kids keep right on talking, Barry.
Eichmann set up labor indoctrination camps in Austria in 1937 to get the Austrian Jews to Israel. In 1937, Eichmann traveled to Israel and met the heads of the Jewish agency and arranged the transfer of as many indoctrinated Jews to Israel in return for the continuation of the transfer agreement.
Okay, hold that thought. Our guest has been Barry Samish. We're talking about the true story of the Holocaust, the story you'll never hear on major radio or television in America. All right, Barry, you got 3 minutes. Go for it.
According to Hecht, Eichmann dressed Kastner in an SS uniform and took him to Belsen, a concentration camp, to find a few of his friends to save. If you can imagine that. Jewish Agency of Palestine is hosted by Eichmann, who gives him Kastner an SS uniform. Kastner was on the Jewish Council. The Hungarian Jews had nowhere to turn but this council. He spread the lie that they would be shipped out to work camps where they would survive the war, when in fact he knew they were going to death camps. This is the same as the Yesha Council, the Council of Judea and Samaria, being used to clean the Jews out of Gush Katif or Gaza. No different. What Kastner did was he saved 3,500 Jews and told Eichmann to get rid of the rest. Get rid of them. That was the word he used. Get rid of the rest. There was one person who knew the secrets of Kastner and Eichmann, and that was a Swedish diplomat named Raoul Wallenberg.
Is that the reason they did him in?
That's the reason the Jewish agency murdered Raoul Wallenberg. He knew too much. The word was spread the Russians did it. Why would the Russians kill Raoul Wallenberg? He was a Swede who never had anything to do with Russia. It was very, very simple. Everyone involved in the destruction, the deliberate destruction by the Jewish agency of 800,000 Hungarian Jews, they were all murdered one after another. Kastner by the Shabak. Eichmann was brought to his room, put into a soundproof booth, and apparently murdered afterwards. And Raoul Wallenberg disappeared after the war. They got rid of everyone who could have opened their mouths and prove that the likes of Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann and the leadership of labor Zionism, their goal was to destroy the Jews of Europe and start again with a new Jew, a Sabbatean Jew, in Israel.
Well, we're out of time, Barry, but I fear the same thing is going to occur very, very soon. And again, I believe that the war is coming, and heaven help the Jewish people. God bless. Thanks very much.
You're later.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program with Lipson with Barry Samish. And Barry has a tremendous understanding, and he could tell a story like this, being Jewish, far better than I could. And if I were to make the statements he makes, why, they'd call me out as Semitic. It's hard to call a Jewish patriot as Semitic. And this is one reason we'd love to have Barry on our program, and we'll have him on telling this story several times this week. And, of course, Radio Liberty does have a unique opportunity. We're on 3 different networks. We do 5 hours of talk radio a day. We have somewhere between 60 and 65 outlets at the present time. Now, some of them are shortwave, internet, some of them are satellite. But, of course, at least across America, people are hearing the truth. A lot of the programs are just simply Saturday programs, and they're heard, for half an hour. But our job is to get people to hear, and hopefully they'll go to our website and they'll start listening to our programs on the Internet or get a shortwave and start listening. And the audience is growing, but of course we need your help. If you're in a position to help us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will certainly get my material. The Brotherhood of Darkness is the book that I wrote on this subject. Our talk on the forbidden secret, on the secret knowledge, on the planned police state. There's so many four tape sets and DVDs we produced. The World Revolution, one of my favorites, where you'll actually hear the American ambassador to Cuba at the time of the Cuban Revolution, a man named Ambassador Earl T. Smith, who actually was a multi-billionaire. He's the only billionaire I ever really met, but he was very gracious when we took a film crew down to Palm Beach, Florida, and he tells the story, you'll hear it on the DVD, about how the American State Department knew Fidel Castro was a communist, and the CIA knew Fidel Castro was a communist, and they brought him to power in Cuba, the best enemy money could buy. And, of course, you certainly wouldn't want to get our DVD by that title, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, my interview with Professor Anthony Sutton. We have the information. You need to get it. You need to help us get the information out. We do have a wonderful video. We haven't talked about it in a long time, but it's called Operation Keelhaul. That's Operation Keelhaul. It's the story of how at the end of the Second World War, the United States government and England and France and the Allies had approximately 6 million Russians who didn't want to go back to Russia, who hated Russia. They sent them back to be killed. And of course, 2 million were immediately killed, and 2 million were sent to the Siberia to die there, and those frozen wastes of Siberia, and the other 2 million, well, they were simply nomads in their own land. They could never have a home. They could never get a job, and it was a constant reminder to the people of Russia that Russia was working very closely with the leaders of America, and they had no hope of ever living a better life. No reason to try to escape. The Allies, the Americans, will send you back again. Operation Keelhaul, we have a video on that. You really want to get it, you want to watch it. You want to understand the story, because you're never going to hear it elsewhere. And then, of course, we do hope you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, and listen to our radio programs, watch our videos, watch our new section called Other Videos. And there are links to important clips that you should be watching from YouTube. And then, of course, reading the newsletters that are there available. And they're all free. We want you to get the material. And, of course, we hope you'll go to our section. And we do have some items that are available. So our four tape sets, our DVDs, the books, all of them will help you to understand what's going on and, of course, to help us get the information out across America. Remember, we are going to be putting on a conference, an all-day conference on the 26th of October here in the North Shore of Monterey Bay, bringing in great speakers from across the country. Mark that down in your catalog there, on your appointment book, and if you can come, we certainly appreciate it. You have to know ahead of time, of course, because, of course, we're going to be serving lunch. So you can call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in coming to our conference. If you'd like, of course, to get some of the items we talked about, the video on the Holocaust, my book on the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, we'll be back till tomorrow. May the Lord be with you.